with the BLM, Kanab, Utah.
Brian Johnson, non-consumptive, Enoch, Utah.
Dale Bagley, representing an elected official.
Nick Jorgensen, non-consumptive, out of St. George, Utah.
And I'm Mike Worthen. I'm a non-consumptive in Cedar City, Utah, or at large in Cedar City.
Kevin Bunnell, I'm the regional supervisor for the division in Cedar City.
Gene Boardman, I'm representing the public at large.
Craig Lobb from Iron County, representing agriculture.
McNarell Bicknell, representing agriculture.
Okay, thank you. We excuse Chairman Black. He had another commitment, so I will be filling in. And let's move on to the procedures on how the RAC is going to be handled tonight. First, we will have a report from the Wildlife Board update and acceptance of the minutes first, then the Wildlife Board update. Then we will move into the procedures or the recommendations that are being put forth tonight. First off, the division will make the recommendations, give us some history, and then we will open it up for questions from the public. And please keep in mind that these are just questions, they're not comments. Then we will open it up for questions from the RAC members.
Actually, questions from the RAC first.
And then RAC, okay, it's the other way around. Questions from the RAC and then questions from the public. And then we will have comments from
the RAC. The public.
The public. If you want to make comments, please fill out a yellow card and hand it to one of the division employees, and they'll bring it up front. When you come up front, please state your name and who you represent, and please limit your comments to around 3 minutes if possible. Then we will have comments or consider motions from the RAC and go from there. So, first on the agenda, review and acceptance of the RAC minutes from the past agenda.
I'll make a motion that we accept the minutes and the agenda.
I'll second it.
Okay. We have a motion by Dale to accept the minutes from the past agenda, seconded by Nick. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion passes. And we'll move into an update of the Wildlife Board by Kevin.
Okay, the Wildlife Board was just last Friday, and so we're almost back-to-back here with the board meeting. If you remember the last, one of the main things on our last RAC were the elk management plans and then the season dates for once bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime, and then also the procedures on how we run our drawings. The board passed the elk management plans as presented by the division, which is also the recommendation that came out of our RAC, of the Southern RAC. On the bucks, bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime season dates and application time. That was passed with a couple of amendments. The first, if you remember, there was a proposal from Yuba to add some archery hunts at the end of our once-in-a-lifetime seasons. And then there was a proposal from the division to just add 7 days on the end of each of those hunts, and they, rather than having a specific archery-only hunt. The board decided instead of taking the whole Yuba proposal, they just took two units. A goat hunt on the north slope of the Uintas, and then a bison hunt on the Henry Mountains. So there'll be archery-only once-in-a-lifetime hunts on those two units as kind of a test run, and then they decided not to have the 7-day extensions with the division's proposal. So So that's the way that went. They also did accept the recommendation from our RAC to keep the Boulder Mountain on the late general season buck hunt. I guess it becomes a limited entry buck hunt, but those limited muzzleloader hunts that are in the first part of November. On the preference points, that was passed as presented, as was the Northeastern Region Deer Management Plan, and the CWMU and Landowner Association recommendations were accepted as presented. There was a fairly long discussion about the Deer Creek CWMU. If you remember when Covey presented that, he talked about how that had been a CWMU that in the past we'd had some issues with in terms of how the public hunters were being treated. They went away for a year. They were applying to come back. The board put a requirement on that CWMU that after this year that they will report back to the CWMU Advisory Committee and then to the board with the option of their COR being suspended if they're not meeting the expectation in terms of the way the public hunters are being treated on that CWMU. I'm glad to try to answer any questions, but that's the way the board meeting went down.
Why did they not approve the 7-day extension?
Well, if you remember, there was the division's proposal for a 7-day extension, and there was the Yuba proposal to do just limited entry hunts, and it was kind of an either or thing, not instead of both. And so they didn't take the whole Yuba proposal, but they decided to go that route, but limit it to two hunts rather than I think there was four that were being proposed by Yuba. Any other questions?
Okay, you just want to give the regional update?
Yeah, as far as regional update, it seems like it wasn't too long ago that we met, so I'll be quite brief. John?
At the Wildlife Board, did they pass that extra language that was recommended at the Southern RAC on the elimination of problem?
That was reviewed and looked at in terms of we looked at the language that was in the statewide plan, which is kind of the overarching, and felt like that the language that was in there was, it already covered all of that, that there was already adequate language to, that it was talked about and decided that the language that was existing would cover the recommendation. Thanks for bringing that up, John. I'd forgotten about that. In terms of regional update, probably the main thing for everybody to be aware of is the antelope trap that was scheduled for the end of this week has been postponed. Right now we're tentatively looking at January 18th, 19th, and 20th. We did some flights over the area where the two traps are, and the pronghorn just aren't in the area yet. There hasn't been enough weather to congregate them and move them down towards where the traps are, and so that's a huge undertaking, both in terms of the expense of our employees and also the expense of having a helicopter capture company in the area. And so we've, in hopes of getting additional weather and helping us be effective when we run that trap and remove the number of animals we need to, we've chosen to postpone that for now. Teresa or Jim, anything you want to add to that?
Saw 80 on Cyclone Rolls.
So they're moving. I think we had less than 100 within 10 miles of the two traps when we flew, so that wasn't going to get it done. The other bit of news, Dustin Scheible, who was our biologist on the Panguitch Lake and Zion units, has accepted a position with the BLM in Cedar City, and so we have a vacant biologist position open right now, and we're working through the process of filling that vacancy. Other than that, we had our regional Christmas party that you guys were all invited to, and I think Rusty was the only one that showed up, and you guys, you know, your loss. So we had a good time and enjoyed that opportunity. So are there any questions for me in terms of things that are going on in the region that I can answer? All right, Mike.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to the recommendation section. We'll first have up Blair Stringham to present the waterfowl recommendations and rule amendments in 2017.
All right. No, you're good. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tonight I'll be presenting the 2017-18 waterfowl recommendations. And much of what we do, I mean, the waterfowl world is based on habitat. So I first wanted to give an update just on breeding conditions across most of the breeding areas in North America. For the most part, if you compare these two maps between 2015 and 16, for the most part, things were similar. We had probably good, very good breeding conditions across most of the breeding areas in North America where waterfowl are nesting. Really, the only dry spot we had is kind of that corner between Minnesota, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, and that's actually where a lot of our birds come from. So we did see a reduced flight this last year, and that was probably likely due to just drier conditions in that area. But overall, things did look pretty good. How that translates into our waterfowl populations. Duck numbers, again, this year were near record highs. It was the second or third highest survey we've ever had. We were sitting right near, just below 50 million ducks. So ducks are doing really well. How that compares across species, most species are doing about the same as they were last year. There were a few species that were up, and really the only notable one this year were pintails, which dropped down quite a bit from where they were last year. They still remain about 30% below their long-term average. So in the duck world, they're really about the only species we have a lot of concerns about. The way our regulations shake out for ducks in the Pacific Flyway, it's based on the population of mallards, and so on the survey just showed you. Because mallard populations continue to do well, and we were given the liberal package again, which is a 107-day season and a bag of seven birds. The only thing that changes from last year are a pintail bag limit. Because they declined again this year, they dropped below a threshold where we can have a two-bird bag, so we have to reduce that to a one-bird bag for next year. So this probably will have some implications for hunters in Utah because we do see a large number of pintails, and they do make up a pretty good part of our bag here, so hunters will have to be aware of that for next year. The populations for our swans and geese in the Pacific Flyway continue to do well. Our tundra swan population has been stable for quite a while now. We've seen quite a bit of increase in our Canada goose population as well as our Ross and snow goose population. They've continued to increase both locally and as well as across the continent. So getting to our recommendation portion, we have seen a lot of interest from waterfowl hunters in this part of the state who have wanted to see a later waterfowl hunt for both ducks and geese. As we looked at this as a division, we found that there are probably a lot of opportunities that could be gained by splitting our season and having a later hunt here in the southern part of the state. It would give hunters across the state more opportunity to hunt, so more days outside of the 107-day season that we can have. It also allows us to have two youth days and two openers in the state. It's been really popular to have our opener and youth day in the northern part of the state, and this will allow us to do one down here in the southern part of the state as well now and give people an opportunity to go to two of those if they like. And we've also seen that this warmer weather we've had over the last decade has reduced our migration in this part of the state early in the season. And so by pushing our season later into January, we'll likely have a lot better hunting opportunities down here in this part of the state. And we can also structure our scop season to have a longer scop season in the state as well. There's been growing interest from people to hunt scop later in the year, and currently we only have an 86-day season for them, so we could have a longer season overall in the state now too. So where that zone would occur would be this white part on this map would be the northern zone, and the green part would be the southern zone, so going across Utah, essentially across I-80 and Twilla County, and everything south of Utah, Duchesne and Uinta counties would be in the southern zone. So for our season dates, the northern zone would begin on October 7th, and the southern zone would begin on October 14th. For our scop season, we'd be able to start the scop season quite a bit later. We'd start on November 3rd and run it till the end of the season, which would give us our 86-day season in this part of the state. For bag limits, nothing will change from last year other than that one pintail, and coot, snipe, and falconry are all the same. For our goose zones, we do change our goose zones up a little bit. We're able to create essentially where that southern boundary was for ducks and make that our southern boundary for goose as well. And that allows us to eliminate that split that we've had in the season down here. So the season will start on October 14th and run till January 17th, the same as ducks. And in the other parts of the state, the zones are essentially the same other than that northern zone, which had to be modified to create this southern zone. For light goose numbers, we have our light goose season open primarily when we see the most number of snow and Ross geese in our state. And so we have a few that come through in the fall, so we open it for a portion there, and then primarily we see them in the spring, and a lot of them are moving through Millard County. And so we're hunting these birds in the spring, and we'll have Millard County closed, though, from February 5th to February 28th to accommodate the Snow Goose Festival in Delta. Tundra swans, no changes here, same season dates and number of permits. On our youth day, because we do have 2 day youth days now, the first one will occur on September 23rd and the second will be on September 30th. That'll be for youth that are 17 or younger on July 31st, and they do have to have an adult with them on this hunt. And anyone older than 15 would need a duck stamp as well. One additional rule change we're making, and we are creating our new rest area to our Ogden Bay Waterfowl Management Area. And this area is directly west of the headquarters and should provide an area for birds to rest and should make hunting better overall in that general area. We also are looking to redefine our boundaries for our learning center at Farrington Bay, and this is a new center that we're building out there, and we currently need to adjust that to be a specified area that we'll designate as the learning center, and that'll be closed to the discharge of firearms. We're also modifying some of our SWAM application process, and we currently don't allow youth hunters to apply as a group, so we're making that change. And we also, before we started preference points for swans, we were holding back 1% of those permits, so that if we did have any issues with our swan drawing, we'd be able to rectify it, because we can't offer more than 2,000 permits, but that hasn't been necessary for about a decade now, and so we're looking to just do away with that language, because we have things in place now where we can not have to hold back 1% of the permits. And lastly, we also need to redefine the definition of youth in this rule for crane and swan applications. Currently, it's listed as 15 or younger, and we want it to be similar to the other definition we have for waterfowl hunting now. That's all the changes I have, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, thank you. Any questions from the RAC? Okay, go ahead, Dale.
Where you've got two season openers, do you anticipate crowding problems? I mean, are you going to have a shift of hunters from the north going south and south-north? I mean, do you anticipate that creating any problems?
We currently do have some hunters that come down to the southern part of the state for the general opener, so it's like there will be a few more hunters coming down. But, I mean, honestly, it would just be, I guess, speculation now. I guess we'll run it the first year and kind of see what happens. So.
One other question. How do you, I mean, you got a bag limit of one pintail. I'm not really a duck hunter. So how do you differentiate a different breed of duck? I mean, you got a flock of ducks coming in.
Shoot the one with the green hat.
Yeah, it can become a challenge for sure, especially early in the year. That's one thing that waterfowl hunters and our hunting regulations have always relied on, is just hunters' ability to identify their birds. And so but we do have quite a few species that allows for two. One will be a little more tricky for some guys, and they'll have to be more careful next year.
Okay, any other questions from the RAC? Questions from the audience?
Got a lot of brown in that audience.
Yes. Seeing none, then we will entertain comments from the RAC. Go ahead, Lane.
I just have one comment. I have received several emails and phone calls from local guys here in Sevier County that are definitely in, you know, they're liking the idea of having the split season. Gives them a little longer, because a lot of them are just like Blair said, you know, we're not seeing the migration down here that we have in past years earlier in the season. So everybody's in favor of what you proposed.
Okay, any other comments from the RAC? Any comments from the public? Seeing none, we will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I make a motion that we accept the waterfowl recommendations as presented.
Any second? Seconded by Brian. All in favor?
Any opposed? Seeing none, motion carries unanimously. Okay, the next item of business is the 2017 Black Bear Recommendations and Rule Amendments by Rusty Robinson.
Let me correct the agenda there a minute. I should have announced this with the regional updates, but Darren DeBlois has just accepted, I mean, when I say just, like Thursday of last week or Wednesday of last week, a promotion as the new mammals coordinator, and so he's jumping right into the fire and starting on a rack tour within his first week of being on the job. So thank you, Darren.
Thank you. Unfortunately, Rusty's a lot better looking than I am, so you're going to have to put up with it tonight, but... Yeah, literally started yesterday. So, like I said, I feel kind of like a shaft in the whirlwind, but we'll do our best tonight. Obviously, if there are any questions that you have, I'll try my best to answer them, and the region's here to bail me out if there's anything specific. So, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. So I'll be presenting the 2017 Black Bear Harvest Recommendations, and we'll just kind of go through it. Let me just give you a quick update. You'll see on the slide there our Utah black bear habitat, just to kind of orient everybody. We feel like we've had about a 4% growth annually based on some of our denning data. So black bear populations statewide are growing. We do see that trend somewhat slowing over time. And like I said, that's based on both our harvest data, which we look at life tables to get an idea of our numbers, and then our denning data looking at production. So last few years of harvest success, just overall throughout all the hunts, 2014 we're about 50% success, 2015 47% success, and then 2016, this is based on partial data, this is kind of what we had when Rusty put the presentation together, we're at about 40%. I suspect that will rise a little bit, but most of that data I think is in, so we're probably seeing a little bit of a downward trend. We've also made some changes in how we hunt black bears in the recent past, and so that could have something to do with it too. And there on the bottom you see just the total number of bears we've taken in those years. Here's just a graph showing the number of permits over time from about 1990 until the current year. And then the yellow line shows our harvest. So there's a little bit of a dip this year. And again, that some of that's because we don't have all the harvest data in again. But increasing trend, and that probably reflects our increasing population. This graph shows since about 2000, about the last decade, what our depredation and nuisance mortality has been. So that includes things that Wildlife Services has taken, and for the most part, they're the ones that handle that, but also any bears that were in depredation situations or nuisance situations that we had to euthanize. So bears in campgrounds that were repeat offenders or aggressive bears, those kinds of things. And then just as a way of reminder, just overall, kind of a reminder of how we hunt bears in Utah on a unit-by-unit basis. Division biologists have the opportunity to choose one of three harvest regimes, light, moderate, or liberal. And as a general rule of thumb, light harvest is for units where we're maybe trying to grow that population. We've got low densities, and we feel like there aren't any human conflicts, and we can maybe grow. Moderate is more of a maintaining type of hunt strategy, so we've got what we want. We maybe want to maintain where we are. And then liberal is where perhaps we have a lot of human conflicts, campgrounds, cabin associations, or livestock depredation, where we're actually trying to reduce the number of bears. And so the units throughout the state will fall into one of those categories. And the plan has percentages of about how many of those. Most of them are in the moderate category, most of our units. Based on the harvest strategy, that's how we determine how we adjust permits year to year. So in a liberal unit, you're a little more aggressive. And you can make those adjustments. You look at where you are with regards to the targets, the number of males in the harvest, and the bracket of female percentage in the harvest, and then you make your adjustments from there. We also have a lot of ways to hunt bears in Utah, and again, this is something that's relatively new. Spring limited entry opportunities where it's hounds only with no bait, April 1st through June 2nd. Summer limited entry seasons, again, bait, spot and stalk, no hounds. Baiting can occur up to 2 weeks early before the hunt starts, so people can get in there, get their bait stations set up, and start getting bears coming into those stations before the hunt. June 3rd through June 30th, there's a fall limited entry opportunity. Again, they can bait up to 2 weeks before the season starts. There's a little bit of some regional variation here. LaSalle's and San Juan have had issues with dogs and conflicts with other hunters, and so they've changed their season dates a little bit to try to accommodate that. Buckcliffs, Bitter Creek, the Buckcliffs is a fairly small summer range, and so you're piling people on top of each other, and so they're trying to separate hunters of different species in time because they can't separate them in space as well, and so there's a little bit of a difference there. And then finally there's the spot and stalk limited entry, and you can see the dates there for those seasons and units. There's a multi-season hunt, so this is where you can hunt all the limited entry seasons. Again, baiting can occur 2 weeks early, and those dates you should have in your packets, so you can see what those are. And if you have any questions, obviously, let's address those. And then the final type is a harvest objective hunt, and these are primarily for units where we've got bear problems, and so we're trying to take a quota of bears and get those populations addressed. And so there's two seasons here, one on the 9 Mile in fall, and then there's a spring hunt as well. So now for the regional recommendations. Here are our northeastern region units on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, I've indicated whether anything is changing or not. You can see that they haven't made any permit changes. One note on that, there is an error in your packet for the multi-season Buckcliffs Bitter Creek South unit. I believe it says October 3rd through November 16th. And it's correct for the fall season, which is the same season for the multi, but that's a typo. So it should be October 2nd through November 16th for that on that table. If you have any questions on any of this, let me know. We'll come back to it okay. Northern region, we have two kind of mega units in the northern region. So the one is Cache, East Canyon, Morgan, South Ridge. Those permits we actually increased quite a bit last year, and so we're going to keep those the same and kind of see how things go. Same thing on the other unit, the Chalk Creek Camas South Slope Summit, same as last year. Central region, they've been having increasing densities on the Central Mountains Nevo unit, and so the Central Region's request that we increase permits by 5 on that unit. And if you look in the different hunts, the number in parentheses is the change from previous years. So spring is going up 3. That's how those 5 permits will be divvied out amongst those seasons. Wasatch Mountains has a quota during the spring season. But the permit numbers are the same for that unit. Southeastern region, they've had quite a bit of Wildlife Services take, and so they're trying to increase permits in order to give hunters opportunities to take those problem bears. And so you can see the increases there to reflect their concerns along those lines. There is a quota on the 9 Mile. And they're increasing that quota by 2 this year. There's one in the spring and then again in the fall. And S&S is spot and stalk. The Southeastern region also made a unit boundary change, and I believe this is to what we've tried to do over the last year is make all our unit boundaries the same for all species, so you don't have to figure out different maps for different species, and so this reflects that change. The red circle is where we're looking here. You can see they've kind of bumped out a little section and changed it there. In order to accommodate that, the neighboring unit had to change, so they've just switched some of that ground into the LaSalle unit, but now all those units ought to be the same for all species. Southern region. Beaver units going down two. Philvor, Pavant is and Monroe will stay the same. Mountain Dutton increasing by one. Pangridge Lake, Zion by one. Ponsagant reducing by one. And then the plateau units are remaining the same. And again, in the prints, you can kind of see where those cuts and increases will be taking place. Pursuit season. So we have a season to pursue bears with hounds. These are the general pursuit seasons. So across the state, unless a unit has a specific difference or reason to be different, these are the season dates next year for pursuit. Spring, summer, and fall. And then finally, on the pursuit stuff, there are some restricted units, and those are the dates that will be different. In fact, they've got permits that are issued for that, and this primarily is a crowding issue. It's to address a lot of people in the field during the summer and fall. A lot of these are taking place during a little bit of, well, just before our tree season and that kind of thing. So that's why those are different. And then just in summary, total permits we're recommending this year is 760. That's a 48 permit increase overall statewide, 16 in the spring, 14 in the summer, 11 in the fall, 5 in the multi-season, and 2 additional harvest objective quota permits on the 9 mile. And then that San Juan and LaSalle boundary change. And that's all I've got tonight.
Okay, thank you for your report. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Yes, go ahead, Craig.
I was just wondering how come you... Well, I got two questions. One, how come on the beaver you went down to? I was up there this summer and saw my first bear up there. I mean, in the flash, not just the sign. But, mm-hmm. And then my other question was back on the first page there. Why your conflict there in 14 was so high compared to your average has been pretty even across there, and then 14 it jumped way high.
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer that. If you look at the numbers, they're not big numbers, and so a little change looks like a big old bump. Mm-hmm. But I'm not entirely sure. And then Teresa can probably answer on the beaver.
So we went down because we're managed under the liberal strategy, and that's 40 to 45% female harvest, and the three-year average is 53%. So the female harvests have been increasing. So we bumped a few down to try to help with that, to stay within the management goal there.
So your conflict's not a problem there then, huh?
This year actually hasn't been as bad. We had minor conflicts. The conflicts have increased over the last several years, but this year has been pretty good. So...
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Back on your first page where you're talking about harvest and evaluation, or no, down one more from that.
Oh, okay.
It's on the depredation nuisance
All right.
mortality. Uh-huh. Do you track separately those that you have to kill versus those that you move?
I'm sure we do, but I don't know that I can give you those numbers. Maybe Kevin.
All of these on here were killed.
Yeah, these are all mortality, so these are ones that are taken.
But we do have a database where we keep track of all of our nuisance bear responses, Nick.
And I can look that up for you, Nick, if you want to.
I'm just curious how many, what the ratio is moved versus killed.
Okay. Yeah, let me make a note.
Okay, other questions?
Yeah, one more question on that same issue. What do you use to determine whether you move it or kill it?
So we have a nuisance bear response policy, and when we respond to problem bears, we categorize those bears based on, you know, aggressiveness, overall damage, that kind of thing. And so really what it boils down to is do we feel comfortable that that bear could be moved and then not become an issue somewhere else? And so, and I can get you that detailed sort of hierarchy of how we classify those bears, Nick, if you want. But but we do have a policy that we follow every time we respond to a bear.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything else from the rack?
I've got a question.
Okay. Go ahead, Brad.
Does anybody know how many bears that were actually taken on the Penguin Zion hunt this year? Well, just wonder what that number is. I've got friends that are sheep farmers that just got hammered this year. Okay.
Okay, she's looking it up. And you mean harvested on the seasons or just overall?
Just sheep that just got absolutely hammered this year up on the Penguin and Zion. Just was wondering how successful they were, if the numbers have gone up since we lengthened the summer season.
Right.
Two bear harvested.
They're like unicorns on that unit. It's tough.
Any taken by Wildlife Services, Teresa?
We killed a bear. I don't know the Wildlife Services killed one of those penguin sign. But if that's accurate,
okay.
Seven
the previous year. I mean, those were Wildlife Services.
Those are sport
harvests. Well, those were sport harvests the previous year.
And the two was Wildlife Services or sport harvests?
Sport harvests.
Okay. Any other questions from the rack? Okay, questions from the public? Seeing none, then go ahead, Brian.
The pursuit seasons, do those have preference points that you're putting in for those?
Good question. I don't know the answer to that. Do you know, Kevin?
I'm not sure, Brian, but it would be bonus points instead of preference points if they did, because it's limited entry, I believe. But let me find out for sure.
I just have a buddy that's like, I can't draw one.
They would have either. I don't know that we have anything that's a draw that doesn't have either a bonus point or a preference point associated with it. But I'll get an answer for you.
I'll let you know tonight. I'll check. I've got it here. I can look it up.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Do we think we should? You guys run dogs?
Yeah. Okay. Do we have any more questions from the rack? Questions from the public?
I already asked for questions.
Okay. Then let's have comments from the public. And if you have comments, please come up to the mic over here.
We have one from Bryce Pilling.
Bryce Pilling.
One comment card's all I have on this one.
And please state your name for the record.
Bryce Pilling, Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Darren. We support the proposal as presented. Thank you.
Thanks, Bryce. And then John Keeler.
And John Keeler.
John Keeler, Utah Farm Bureau. We had multiple individuals on the northern sandpeat area that sheep producers that had a huge problem with bear this year. A couple of producers had their herd split on the east and west side of the valley were being hit. at the same time, losing 30 to 40 head of sheep. And so we feel like there's a problem up in that area. We see that there's a recommendation for 5 increase on the Nebo side, but we feel like there needs to be 5 increase on the Manti North.
Okay, thank you, John. Let's go ahead and have comments from the rack.
This fall, when everybody had trail cameras out on the boulder looking for bull elk, they said they didn't see any bull elk. All they saw was bears and cougars. And your population, you know, is, I guess, the same on the boulder, but yet they've had more, either that or they had a lot more trail cameras, one or the other. So I don't know, how do you get your population for bears?
It's based on a couple of things. One is we look at the age of harvest, and if we have enough bears in that unit that are harvested, we can back our way into an estimate for population. That a lot of times where we have small numbers of permits, we've got to look at a larger scale. And then we also look at our denning data, so we're looking for birth pulses when we have cubs in the den, and we can make an estimate for numbers of bears, or how the it's actually a growth rate. You know, how's the population growing over time?
Okay, do we have another? Yeah, go ahead.
Jim, would you come down and just speak to nuisance and depredation problems on the boulder? What did we experience this last summer?
This summer was one of the quietest summers we've had in many years on the boulder for depredation and nuisance both. We do have a tremendous population of bear there. We do see bears on cameras by the loads. I have people who bait and put cameras on bait that are waiting for that one big giant bear. And so the 7 other bears that come to the bait, they don't shoot. They don't even try. So I have a great population of bears on the boulder, and the permit numbers that we've recommended reflect that. And if we have bear get in sheep, we call Kevin. He takes care of them. Or cattle, for that matter. He's really good to come and help us. Any other questions?
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, thank you. And go ahead, Craig.
I just going to comment on the boulder there. When I was over there elk hunting, I didn't see him or have a run in with him, but they said there was a bear there that was kind of not very shy. Mm-hmm. He'd stand up and snap at him and stuff. So I wondered if he was a moved bear, being that way, but I don't know. But others run into him, but I didn't, so yeah. I can't say.
Don't think we moved anything to the boulders. We've got plenty of bears there, so, and typically we'll mark them if they got ear tags. Oh, have you? Okay, it would have a collar. So.
Okay, any other comments?
There's a question. Where do you move most of your bears to?
Do you want to speak for the region, Teresa?
We typically don't move very many bears. Oftentimes, they'll fall in the category that if we're going to take action, if they're a public nuisance, often we do euthanize those. If they do come in contact with livestock, Wildlife Services takes care of those ones. But if there is a bear that we move, we've moved a few over the years on top of the boulder. We moved one this last year. It was getting into trouble in Marysville, and they will be collared and marked if we move them.
Rumor has it the Marysville one came back. Is that rumor or not?
You know, 2 or 3 years ago, we had a Marysville one that we moved from Bullion Canyon on top of the mountain. Within a month, she was back at the same, I think she was at the Fireman's Park up there. if they do that twice.
I think he's talking about the recent
one. Yeah, the recent one, we had one there, apparently rumors the other day. That turned out to be a deer. Yeah, it... Vance looked into that one.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Teresa. Go ahead, Brian.
Do we have any success, a harvest success on this summer hunt? It's, I know we've done it 2 years now. I was wondering if we had any averages or what their kill percentages are on that.
It tends to be a lower success hunt. Is there a particular unit you wanted to, you were wondering about?
Pick one that's got a lot. Elk Ridge, San Juan Elk Ridge. There's 15. Or
what unit number is that, Teresa? Elk Ridge.
14.
14.
13
San Juan. Is that's the whole unit, right? 14.
Yeah.
Looks like success on the summer. Actually, on that unit was about 60%. Looks like last year and the year before, 100. But that's how many permits is that? Like 3 and 6 permits, so
basically double the permits.
Yeah, but small sample size. So, yeah.
Okay. Any other comments from the rack? Okay, let's see if we have a motion.
Some comments we have. We do have one.
Okay.
Recommendation from Farm Bureau to increase 5 permits on the North Manta.
Okay, the recommendation is from the Farm Bureau to increase 5 permits on the North Manti, and I think that's about all the recommendations we had.
Through the comments, from public comments.
Yep, yeah, from publics.
Can you repeat that, please?
So we did just the comment that Farm Bureau made. They made a recommendation to increase by 5 permits on the North Manti. That was through the public comment.
Okay. Go ahead, Craig.
I'll make a recommendation that we accept the deal with the amendment to increase on the Manti, the 5 that where they're having trouble.
Okay, is there a second? Seconded by Dale. Questions?
Not questions. Well, for Craig there.
Okay.
Can we amend that to can we amend that to include bonus points on the harvest?
On the pursuit.
On the pursuit permit. Would you be okay with that?
Fine with me.
Okay.
Or is it okay with the second?
So, okay. So let me clarify here. So the motion, as it is stands right now, is to accept the division's recommendation as proposed, with the exception of adding 5 permits on the North Manti, and recommend that we add bonus points or preference points to the summer pursuit. Brian?
It would be a bonus point to slow an entry, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it would be a bonus point.
Okay. So that's...
Craig made the initial motion.
Yes.
Right, because we did have a second on that.
Well, but Craig did indicate that he was willing to just make Brian's suggestion part of his original motion.
And the second agreed.
So we've got one motion that kind of came from two sources, but Craig's agreed to make it part of his motion. Seconded by Dale. Okay, we got it right now.
Where would you put the? Where do you want those tags at?
They didn't specify, so I think we
disperse
that, let the region decide where to put those 5 extra tags. Would be the.
Okay, do we need to restate the motion, or is everybody clear on it?
Have you got it, Mindy?
We're good.
Okay, are we ready to call for question? All in favor? Any opposed? Motion passes. Okay, let's move on to the next agenda item, which is Private Pond Rule Amendments, Rule R657-59. And Randy Oplinger will give us that presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like you said, my name is Randy Oplinger, and I'm the Coldwater Sport Fish Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about some proposed rule changes that we have to our aquaculture and fish stocking rule, and also to our private fish pond rule. Really, before I get into the nuts and bolts of the rule changes that we're proposing tonight, I just want to provide just a little background about what's prompting these rule changes that we're proposing. So these rule changes really primarily affect Utah's private aquaculture industry. This industry is made up of basically businesses who produce fish that people purchase for stocking on private land. And this industry is really an important partner for the Division of Wildlife because there's a lot of private ponds in the state that are on privately owned land. And these are places where particularly kids and families get introduced to fishing, and that helps for the division bolster license sales. So there's kind of a relationship there where, you know, people hear about public waters, that draws interest in fishing, which gets people to stock fish on their private lands. And then conversely, people fishing on private land through fish that are stocked by the private aquaculture industry helps drive interest in some of the public waters in the state. But since 2008, the Division of Wildlife has been having quarterly meetings with the private aquaculture industry with the idea of just hearing some of the concerns that the industry has to try to foster relationship and see what we can do to help the private aquaculture industry within the state. And during some meetings that we had this year, the industry brought some concerns our direction. And what their concerns really boiled down to is they were concerned that some of the rules that the division has in place just limits their opportunities to stock fish in the state. And as a result, it's hampering their business and just limiting the opportunities for the private aquaculture industry to grow within the state. So the primary concerns that the industry had is that, first off, our current rules state that fish cannot be stocked in the privately owned ponds that are in natural stream channels. A second concern is that under our current rules, fish cannot be stocked into privately owned ponds that lack screens, both on the inlet and outlet structures. Those are two of the major concerns. The second concern, or third concern, is they felt that the sterility and species requirements that we have for specific geographic locations within the state just aren't clear under our current rules. So the current rules that we have are really intended to help prevent fish that are stocked on privately owned land from escaping that land and interacting with fish that we have on public land in the state. And that's really intended to help protect native fish in the state. We have several native fish species that have been petitioned in the past for listing under the Endangered Species Act, and we're trying to prevent that listing from happening. We're doing everything we can to manage those species to prevent that from occurring. But certainly within the division, we acknowledge that there are situations where stocking ponds on natural stream channels or ponds that lack screens on both the inlet and outlet structures actually poses very little threat to Utah's native fish. So as a result, what we're proposing tonight is to eliminate Rule R657-16, which is the aquaculture and fish stocking rule. And we want to take the core elements of that rule and combine them with Rule R657-59, which is the private fish pond rule. And the title for the proposed rule is Private Fish Ponds, Short-Term Fishing Events, Private Fish Stocking, and Institutional Aquaculture. And as we looked at these two rules, what we really saw is these two rules both had an effect on the private aquaculture industry. And there was a lot of overlap in language between these two rules. So we saw that combining these two rules was really being an opportunity to reduce this overlap of language, provide more regulatory consistency to the private aquaculture industry, and to provide the industry with just a single rule that's easier to follow and more streamlined than the two rules that we currently have in place. So as part of the combined rule, what we did is we eliminated all parts to these rules that really aren't essential to native fish conservation within the state. We also removed language from the rule that duplicates a corresponding rule that the Department of Agriculture has that has an effect on the private aquaculture industry. And what we're leaving the private aquaculture industry in Utah is really a set of rule requirements that are very similar to what the industry faces in other states here in the western part of the country. So I'm going to kind of show what the current rule looks like, and then I'm on the next slide show what the proposed rule looks like to kind of just highlight some of the changes between the two rules. But right now what we're looking at are basically three criteria that need to be in place before a privately owned pond can be stocked in the state. So we're looking for ponds that aren't located on natural stream channels. We're looking for ponds that have screens on both the inlet and outlet structures. And we're also looking at the fish species that's desired by the pond owner for stocking in the particular area. We're looking for that to be permitted within the area. And basically, if all three of those criteria are met, you kind of follow the left side of that flow chart here. And what it means is the private pond owner doesn't need a certificate of registration from the Division of Wildlife, and they're free to go to a member of the private aquaculture industry, so a business, purchase fish, and stock fish on their land at any time. Now, if the sterility and species requirement is not met for a pond, so in other words, if somebody from the public wants to purchase fish for their private land, and the species and the sterility of fish they're wishing to purchase isn't permitted on their property based on some division requirements in the current rule, what the pond owner is able to do is they're able to go to the Division of Wildlife and request a certificate of registration. And if that certificate of registration is granted, then the industry is, or they're welcome to purchase fish from a business and stock fish under their land. And then on the right side, what we see is under the current rule, the stocking really isn't permitted if the pond is on a natural stream channel or lacks screens on both the inlet and outlet structures. So that's the current rule, and then to contrast it with the rule that we're proposing tonight, what we're looking for, again, those same three requirements. So we're looking for ponds that aren't located on natural stream channels, we're looking for ponds that have screens on both the inlet and outlet structures, and we're looking for whether the fish species the pond owner desires is actually permitted for stocking in the area. And again, if all three of those criteria are met under the proposed rule, no certificate of registration would be required, and the pond owner is free to purchase fish and have fish stocked on their land at any time. Now, under the proposed rule, if any one of those criteria isn't met, what the pond owner can do is they could approach the Division of Wildlife, receive a certificate of registration, and if they receive that, they're free to purchase fish for the stocking on their land. So what we feel is this rule that we're proposing tonight really addresses the industry concerns. First off, the industry wanted to have the ability to stock fish onto ponds that are located on natural stream channels, and under the proposed rule, that's something that they can do if they have a certificate of registration. The industry was also looking for us to remove screening requirements on the inlet and outlet structures. Again, if the pond owner receives a certificate of registration of the proposed rule, they can stock those ponds. The industry is also looking for the ability to stock disease-certified sterile salmonids into any privately owned pond within the state under the proposed rule. That's something that they could do. The one exception is brown trout. Brown trout hybrids are not permitted in Washington County, and that's actually because of recovery agreements. The Division of Wildlife ourselves can't stock brown trout or brown trout hybrids in the Washington County either. Now, it turns out that's down there in St. George. It's so warm that trout don't do well down there, so it's probably not going to have much of an effect on the industry. The industry also wanted just a clarity on where their fish can be stocked within the state. Some of the wording of the proposed rule, I think, provides some of that clarity. And on top of that, the Division of Wildlife has actually developed a web-based smartphone-compatible app that the industry and pond owners can do, where they can basically put in an address, zoom in on a location, and look at the actual sterility and species requirements that are in place for a particular location. The industry also requested some simplification on the reporting requirements, so what they have to report to the Division of Wildlife after fish are stocked. We've simplified some of those requirements under the proposed rule, and we've also developed a simple online reporting tool. So it's basically a computer thing that basically the industry can go into and report their stocking events. It saves some of the paperwork. And also, this tool that we've developed autofills, which is very beneficial to the industry because duplicate information they have to record for each stocking event, like the name of the business, their address, their phone number, etc., is automatically populated, so they don't have to enter that information over and over again. Another request the industry made to us in meetings is they actually preferred certificates of registration over exemptions. So under the rule they're proposing tonight, we're only allowing certificates of registration to be granted instead of exemptions. And really the reason for that is the industry was concerned with the issuing of exemptions because there's a little bit less paperwork and paper trail behind the exemptions. And the industry was really concerned. They wanted to make sure that when they were stocking fish, they were following the letter of law. And by having more of a paper trail behind a certificate of registration, they're able to verify that the division is actually permitting the stocking of fish within an area. What we're doing is we're taking all existing exemptions and we're going to turn them to certificates of registration. And those certificates of registration are going to last for 5 years. Now, under the current rule, they last for 1 year. So under the proposed rule, it's going to last for 5 years. This is going to be very beneficial for pond owners because they have to reapply for certificates of registration less often, which is going to reduce money or their costs and just reduce some of the paperwork. And it's also beneficial to the private aquaculture industry because they know that if a certificate of registration is issued to a pond owner, that it provides them the opportunity, the knowledge that they'll be able to stock a pond for at least 5 years. The one thing that the industry did request is they wanted to have the ability to make these certificates of registration last a lifetime instead of 1 year or 5 years. We went with a 5-year certificate of registration sort of as a compromise because as a division, we feel that we need to have the opportunities to react to changes in the landscape and scientific knowledge in case something happens on a particular property. Now, the last thing is the industry stated to us that they could not document the catch of fish from short-term fishing events. Now, under the current rules, they thought that that was their responsibility. So if somebody sets up, say, a tank in a parking lot and kids are able to catch fish, the industry thought that it was their responsibility to actually document the catch of fish from those. We clarified the rules and say that that's not their responsibility. Instead, it's whoever's, I guess, sponsoring that short-term fishing event's responsibility to record that information. So that's all I have tonight. I'd just like to thank you guys for your time.
Okay, thank you, Randy. Do you have any comments from the RAC or any questions from the RAC?
Do you have one that makes sense?
Okay. Seeing none, do we have any questions from the public?
You have two comment cards on that.
Okay. Comments from the public.
We've got two comment cards.
Two comments. Jesse Burrell.
Hi, Jesse Burrell. I'm with Gunnison Valley High School. We have a little fish system in our school we've been doing for years, a couple of recirculating tanks that we raised trout in, and it was brought to my attention that they were making some adjustments to this that might require us to have a COR or it might require us to pay a fee for that. We've never paid a fee to the state for operating that. We'd like to keep it that way, and the idea of not having a COR would which I think is how it is right now, is desirable due to the paperwork. It's a small part of my program, but the kids benefit from it. And so I'd like to see either a requirement not for me to have a COR or, you know, the 5-year thing is definitely better than a 1-year thing, though. So those are my comments.
Do you have any comments from the division on that issue?
Yeah, just for your information, the proposed rule has no changes whatsoever on institutional aquaculture.
So I would still have a one-year COR?
I could look into that for you. We may have made that a 5-year COR for you, but otherwise the rules have not changed. We basically duplicated the language for institutional aquaculture in the proposed rule.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a comment from Robert Judd.
Thank you, Chair.
Please state your name. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, my name is Robert Judd. I'm with the Utah Aquaculture Association. I'm also a Spring Lake Trout Farm. There are three of us currently left in the state that sell fish live. So you're dealing with a pretty small industry at this point. And we're just trying to change some things to keep afloat and stay alive. But we just want to first off tell the division thank you for the time that they have spent in working with us. Randy knows we've been in meetings many a day throughout this entire year trying to meet with them and go over these rule changes. And for the most part, the rule changes are what we want to see happen. But just like any rule, sometimes there are things that you don't necessarily always agree with. And we'd like to propose two amendments or changes to the rule as it's being presented right now. The first amendment is the institutional aquaculture, which is what Jesse just commented on. Under the rule currently, if you have a CO or if you have a pond and you meet the three, would you mind going back to the little diagram there, Randy? And you meet the three requirements, then you don't need a COR in order to stock the fish. Under the proposed rule, they're leaving the institutional aquaculture the same, which means that they have to have a COR even if they meet all those three requirements. And so what we want to see happen is that just go away, the institutional aquaculture, and that it just falls under the rule like everybody else. If they meet those requirements, they should be able to stock without a COR, without having to tax our school systems more than they're currently being taxed. And that would be the change there, just to eliminate the institutional aquaculture and let it fall right in with the rest of the rule. The second change that we would like to propose and see happen is, if you look up here on the proposed rules, number one, it says the pond owner, if he meets these criteria, does not need a COR. On the first one, it says it's not located on a natural stream channel. The problem with that is that in order to put fish, fish are where there's water. Water is where natural stream channel is. So basically, under that, it states that you can't stock fish anywhere that water runs. And that's basically what it's stating. And so what we are proposing is that instead of trying to define where we cannot stock fish, we'd like to propose that you look at the opportunity to define where you can stock a fish. What we'd like to see proposed is eliminate number one, and in the place of that, put if it is on private land and the water originates on that private land and they meet those other two criteria, then they should be able to stock those fish. If it doesn't originate on their land, then it falls under the other side and you would still need a COR. The benefit of this is that somebody who wants to stock fish has the ability to call up and we can explain to them what the requirement is. Currently, right now, if you called me up, say, Mr. Chair, you called me up and wanted fish, I'd have to ask you if it's on a natural stream channel. Well, that's based on your definition and my definition of what is a natural stream channel. And your definition might be different than my definition, which might be totally different than what the division's definition is. And so we feel like by doing this, it would simplify it and make it much easier. And if you wanted to call up and ask me, can you stock fish, I can basically ask you, does the water originate on your property? Do you screen it? And if you do, if we meet the sterility requirements, then you should be able to stock fish. And that's what we're proposing.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hang on just a minute.
Make sure I'm capturing this so I can help these guys. So your two recommendations, just remove the language
for institutional,
and just make them fall under the same
rule. The rule, just like everybody else.
Yep. And then for altering this part, if the water originates on private land, on the same private land that the pond's on, and it's screened on the downstream side, then remove the requirement.
As long as it originates on private land and you meet the other two criteria, then it should be just fine.
It has to be the same private land.
The same private land as the pond mm-hmm. is on. If the water originates there and it's screened. Okay. Just want to make sure that I'm capturing this so that I can walk through this. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. We have any comments from the RAC? Go ahead, Brian.
I just have a question. That proposal, how does that affect you? I don't understand. Is it better for?
I think this benefits me because I wouldn't have to do a COR.
That's what I thought. I just want to make sure that I was understanding what he was saying.
Okay. Any other comments?
I was just wondering what Randy's thoughts were on changing that number one to the water originating on private land. Does that make a difference to you or the division?
Where it makes a difference, I see the point that Robert's making, first off. And this whole natural stream channel issue is a very difficult issue. And I'm not a lawyer, but we've got lawyers in Salt Lake who we spent a lot of time sitting down with as we were developing this rule. And the fact of the matter is we couldn't really come up with a very nice legal definition to a natural stream channel. That goes to the Supreme Court issues and things like that. What we're really asking for in this rule within the Division of Wildlife is we're just concerned about fish escaping ponds and what potential effect they could have on native fish in those areas. And what we're asking for is just the opportunity to evaluate individual ponds to assess that risk. And, you know, honestly, in our dealings with, you know, pond owners of the Division of Wildlife, we seldom turn down a COR for a stocking request. And we try to bend over backwards to really work with the pond owner and address whatever concerns that are in place. So, you know, we feel as a division that we need to have that in place just to protect our fish, and we just need to evaluate it on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. Anything else, Brian? Okay, anything else from any of the other members of the RAC?
Could I comment on that?
Yeah, well, we're through that, but go ahead. We've got time.
So I appreciate what Randy said. Most of the ponds that we end up stocking are ponds that are on land wholly owned by somebody. They have a small spring or something that wells up on their property. They dam it off, they screen it, and we stock those fish. 85 to 90% of that water is never going to be a water that has any concern as far as native fish species. And one of the other things I forgot to mention on that proposal is we would like to add a fourth line in there where it would actually say if the water is being managed by the division, they would then have to still get a COR. Does that make sense? So if it's a private land and that water generates on their land, but it is being managed by the Division for Native Species, then we would want them to get a COR.
Now, you would want the division to get the COR?
No.
No, the pond owner. Okay.
So if I understand, if you had a native fish, even if it originated on the private landowner's property, but we had, I don't know, what's a native
conservation
fish
of
leatherside chubs upstream in the spring head above the pond that we were managing for, in that instance, even though it originated on the private landowner's property, as the pond is on, it would still require a COR. Is that
correct? Because the division has notified them they're managing that land, that water, for that purpose. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, do we have any other comments from the RAC? Okay, who wants to tackle this motion? Go ahead. Oh, you had a comment card?
Yeah, there was another one. Sorry, John. That one came in.
Okay, go ahead, John.
John Keeler, Utah Farm Bureau. We would like to support the Utah Aquaculture Association recommendations on this issue. We've been involved in the private industry issues for many, many years, and we've watched just the decline continuing to happen, and we feel like these recommendations are reasonable. We do appreciate the division and their willingness to sit down and work on these problems that we have, but these are important issues to the few that we have left, and we want to maintain this industry, and we feel like there are reasonable recommendations and that they should be accepted. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, John. Okay, before we go, any other comments regarding what was just said? Okay, seeing none.
I can summarize this, everything.
Okay, go ahead and summarize it.
Okay, so with the comments we have the issue with Gunnison Valley High School not to require a COR or a fee for institutional aquaculture, and then from the Utah Aquaculture Association, really 3 points, 2 points. One, to just get rid of language that's directed at institutional aquaculture and make them follow the same rules as everyone else, which would mean that if they meet the three requirements, that it's not located on a natural stream channel, it's screened, and the fish species are permitted in the area, then there's not a COR requirement for institutions. Same, just make them follow the same rules as everyone else. The second one, when in relation to stocking on private ponds, if the water originates on the same private land as the pond is located and the pond is screened, then you remove the requirement for a COR, except if the division is managing the water above the pond for a conservation species. Did I capture that? And in that case, they would require a COR. Comment on the other side from the division is that we would like to retain the ability to evaluate those on a case-by-case basis. And then Farm Bureau supports the recommendations from the Utah Aquaculture Association.
Okay. From that, do we have a motion?
Kevin took the words right out of my mouth. So I'll make that a motion.
Okay.
Wait, make what a motion?
Well, you just said.
Division's proposal with the exceptions of.
With the exceptions of the institutional aquaculture not be required to have a COR.
Okay.
Basically what you just said.
What you just read, basically.
You accept that the DWR proposal with.
Following exceptions.
The additional requests. From the Utah Association of Aquaculture.
Okay, do we have a second? Okay.
Hang on. You guys.
We're working on it.
Okay, so. Accept the division proposal
as presented
with the addition of the requests given by the Utah Association of Aquaculture.
Okay. Got it.
I have that on email. If you want, I can email it. I think I've got it. If you're okay with the way I read that straight from my notes, if I captured it, then I think we're okay.
Yeah, mine is just a little simplified.
Same idea. Why don't you email that anyway? We'll put it. We'll make it part of the record.
Okay.
I'll second it.
Okay. Brian seconded it. Any discussion? Okay. Do I have a all in favor? Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Okay, next up is Nathan Owens to present the AIS rule amendments on Rule 657-60.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Owens. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. I'm here to present a few proposed rule changes to Rule R657-60, Aquatic Invasive Species. Just to kind of set the stage a little bit before we jump into the rule changes, Utah's Aquatic Invasive Species Program began in 2007 in response to the threat of quagga mussels being introduced into Lake Mead. The current situation in Utah is we have two mussel-affected waters within our borders. The first is Lake Powell. In 2013, the Wildlife Board listed Lake Powell as an infested water body, meaning that there are multiple age classes of quagga mussels there. Deer Creek Reservoir also is listed. It's listed as a suspect reservoir, meaning that just over 2 years ago now, we had a single water sample show evidence of larval quagga mussels in that single sample. We've done extensive testing since then. No further evidence of quagga mussels has shown up in any of the samples. So we are currently on schedule to officially delist Deer Creek and reclassify it as an undetected water body about a year from now. We have containment programs in place at both these reservoirs, meaning that we have technicians on the ground making sure that no water is leaving the immediate area on any watercraft, as well as any attached mussels on any watercraft equipment or anything else that gets wet. 2016 was a fairly unique year for our program. Up until this point, our primary focus and point of concern was standing water leaving some of these infested water bodies. 2016, that all changed. That year alone, this last season alone, we had over 50 mussel-encrusted boats encountered within the state of Utah. To put that into perspective, all of 2015, we saw a total of fewer than 15. So things have really ramped up just in the last season with the increasing infestation at Lake Powell. In response to that, you know, and kind of responding to some of these new challenges we're seeing, we feel like the Aquatic Invasive Species Program needs to adapt along with that. So jumping into the proposed rule changes, the first proposed rule change, we would like to institute a mandatory dry time in addition to a professional decontamination for all boats found to have mussels attached. Under our current rule, we can have, let's just say, a wakeboard boat leaving Lake Powell that could potentially have several hundred mussels attached. It can go through a quick 1 to 2 hour decontamination, come up to the Wasatch Front, and immediately launch in Jordanelle Reservoir or any other place. We do not feel that that is an acceptable level of protection for our resources. And there are a couple reasons for that. This last year, we had a few experiences down at our I-15 port of entry near St. George where we interdicted boats coming from Lake Mead. Some of these boats had had documented quagga mussels attached to them and had undergone a professional decontamination. Yet, when they showed up at our port of entry, we could not actually confirm that those mussels were dead upon arrival. That's a pretty scary deal. Some of the boats we're seeing pulling out with mussels are very large boats, very complex. Getting up in every one of those nooks and crannies to make sure that we kill any adult attached, that is nearly impossible in some cases, especially when you're dealing with 40 to 50, maybe 60-foot boats. So that's one point of contention. A second one is, up to this point, again, like I mentioned, standing water has been a big concern, and larval mussels, microscopic mussels found in standing water have been the primary point of concern. That, rightly so, that is a point of concern. However, we also have to realize that in order for those larval mussels to start a new population somewhere else, they need to grow within the water column once they're introduced and settle out between 12 to 18 inches of one another in order to successfully reproduce. So, yeah, chances are small, but the chance is still there. The problem is, if you are transporting adult mussels, you are essentially transporting an entire new colony that as soon as they get wet, they are ready to reproduce. So there's really no chance about it. Reproduction will happen. I would like to point out that this mandatory dry time that we're asking for would coincide with the seasonal dry time we currently have in place. So 7 days during the summer, 18 days in the spring and fall, and 30 days in the winter. And I'd also like to just point out that really this is likely to affect probably less than 1% of the boats leaving Lake Powell. This is only going to apply to boats with attached mussels, and those boats currently are the ones that are in Lake Powell for several weeks, if not months at a time, without being moved or pulled out. The second proposed rule change pertains to watercraft leaving infested water bodies. Right now, we have a requirement in place that no standing water can be transported by watercraft upon exit of an infested water body. So the watercraft is drained of all water prior to exiting and leaving the immediate area. We would like to add to that and require that watercraft to be transported down the highway within the state of Utah with all drain plugs pulled out. Again, some evidence this last year has shown that this is necessary. We've periodically conduct administrative checkpoints right outside of Lake Powell, where we check for compliance on the drain plug requirements or the drain requirements coming out of the reservoir. Now, we have technicians on the ramps making sure these boats are drained of water, and we are tagging them as such. The problem is we've had several boats show up at our administrative checkpoints after having been drained on the ramps, and just based on the natural movement of the boat on the trailer going down the highway, when we pull the plug out, all of a sudden more water comes out. So yeah, we're getting most of the water, but we're not getting all of it. This would be a very minimal thing we could introduce. It could potentially have a very big impact. I would also like to point out that every western state in the U.S. is currently working towards this. So this is a big effort for us to kind of maintain some consistency with the rest of the West in their attempts to do this. The third proposed rule change is mostly just a housekeeping issue. We are proposing to remove Colorado from the list of infested water bodies or regions. Colorado is similar to Utah in the sense that back in 2008, they had four different reservoirs show evidence of quagga mussels in water samples. We also had that with Electric Lake and Red Fleet. Like Electric Lake and Red Fleet, all testing done since then has shown no additional evidence of mussels. Those water bodies, both in Utah and Colorado, have since been delisted. Colorado currently has Pueblo Reservoir still listed as infested because they found positive water samples there in 2011. Colorado is going to be removing Pueblo from their infested list in actually next month. No further evidence of mussels, so we are proposing to do the same. This would be essentially asking Colorado not to treat our boaters coming from Red Fleet or Electric Lake as having been to Lake Powell. That's essentially what it is. And the last and final proposed rule change, we'd just like to include some quarantine language under R657-60-11, conveyance or equipment detainment. This will essentially allow our conservation officers the flexibility to restrict watercraft from launching without physically taking possession of the watercraft from the owner. We already currently have this authority under statute. This is just to clarify it under rule, give our officers a little bit more flexibility. We are currently doing this, and this will most likely, again, pertain to boats with attached mussels that we need to make sure stay out of the water to give us that extra bit of protection. It's essentially allowing the boat to stay in the boater's possession while we make sure that that boat will not be launched before it meets our required dry time. And if anyone would like a mussel tea, we are taking orders. So just let us know. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the RAC?
Dale? How do you track a boat that's been basically under quarantine but returned to the owner? How do you track that boat to make sure it doesn't go to another body of water and get launched?
Good question. The way we've handled that this last season is we have our conservation officers periodically call that individual, stop by their place of residence, just ensure that the seal that we apply attaching the boat to the trailer is still intact. So we haven't had any issues with that so far.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay, comments from the public.
Questions.
Or questions from the public.
Not any public left.
No, except for John.
Bryce.
Yeah, I'm Bryce.
We do have one comment card from Bryce, but I just saying
okay.
Support.
Yeah, and we have a comment card that says that the SFW supports the recommendations by the Division on Aquatic Mussel Interdiction. Okay, any comments from the RAC? Seeing none, do we have a... Okay. Gene?
Really, it's a question. I know you want to protect all of Utah's waters, but is there is that quagga mussel, can it survive in higher, colder lakes?
Good question. We commonly get that question. The answer is yes. The quagga mussel is currently thriving in the Great Lakes where it depths it, where it gets a lot colder than anything we see here. Elevation does not seem to be an issue. They're pretty hardy. Dissolved oxygen even does not seem to be an issue. So really the only thing that is a limiting factor is the calcium level in the water.
How did we get rid of them out of Electric Lake?
We did not get rid of them. They were probably never there. There are a couple possibilities with that. It could have potentially been a contaminated sample that we collected. It could also have been we detected the larval form of the mussels, but they did not settle out to within that 12 to 18 inches where they can successfully reproduce, and so they basically just died off.
Okay.
We don't know for sure.
Okay. Do we have a motion? Lane?
I make a motion we accept the invasive species as presented by the division.
And a second. Have Mac seconded it. Okay. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor? Any opposed? Motion passes.
Is that unanimous?
Yes, it was unanimous. And the issue or the agenda item number 9, R657-38, dedicated Hunter's Rule Amendments. And Brian Christensen will be doing that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the RAC. My name is Brian Christensen. I am the State Volunteer Services Coordinator and manage the Dedicated Hunter Program as well. Today I bring before you some proposed rule changes for 657-38. And for those that may not be as familiar with the Dedicated Hunter Program, it's a general season deer hunting program. We apply for it in the big game drawing annually. And this particular program allows participants to hunt 3 consecutive seasons. They can harvest 2 deer during that 3 years, and they get to hunt all of their the archery, muzzleloader, and rifle general seasons in exchange for 32 hours worth of service and a training course and obtaining a COR. Right now we have currently just underneath 8,000 participants in this program, and they have helped contribute just in 2016 alone about 62,000 service hours on habitat projects and wildlife projects in general. So we really value this program. The purposes for this revision today are essentially to update some wording that we have, that we need to mirror some statute language, and also within some of our rules. We intended also to clarify and simplify some portions within this rule and address some common requests that came from participants within the program. Initially, the clarification to this rule, we are proposing to add some language that tells us exactly when a hunting or combination license is required. By statute, you have to have one to apply for or obtain a big game permit. The COR is a little bit different. So what we've done is made it exactly the same as a general or any big game permit. If you apply for it, we acknowledge that you had one at the time, a hunting license at the time, and we don't go back and look for it when we finally get around to printing that first year's permit. The second and third years, we're issuing new permits, and so a dedicated hunter would have to have a hunting or combination license at that time. This is exactly how all other big game permits are done, and we feel that brings it in line. The other part is to add some language about the use of appropriate tackle for each season. We didn't specifically say that in archery you needed to hunt with a bow. In muzzleloader, you had to use a muzzleloader, and so forth. And so we've added that clarification that you do need to do that appropriately. And then the last part here, the wildlife conservation and ethics course, that is a training course required of dedicated hunters once they join, didn't ever really say when you had to take it. We intend it to be once you join the program and not necessarily before or after. We do change that training from time to time, and we want them to take the most current version. In simplification, we have our current rule allows non-residents to purchase all 32 of their service hours, and residents may only purchase 24 if they opt to do that instead of performing service. What we're finding is that the rule also allows donations of materials and goods that the division requests, and those folks that are residents are purchasing their 24 hours and then they'll donate the rest. And so, in essence, they're doing this anyway. We find that this is a very small number of the dedicated hunters that are purchasing all their hours, and this allows the same option for residents as it does non-residents. The suspension provisions, we're in two or three different places, and we've just basically moved them into the last portion and consolidated that. There were a few portions that we removed entirely, and that they were already covered within state statute and didn't need to be duplicated within this rule. One of the bigger changes, though, is this option for military. Our current rule allowed us to give credit, a certain number of hours of dedicated hunter service credit, based on time deployed or mobilized for the military. And that was, the intent was that they were mobilized and out of the state on assignment and unable to be in state performing dedicated hunter service. So it's, in essence, it was a way to waive some hours for those folks. We found that many of the situations that came to us didn't necessarily fit the rule very clearly. And so what we've done is just rewritten that for our military. If they find that they are deployed or activated for a consecutive 3-month period, that we allow them the option of just extending their dedicated hunter program 1 year. They wouldn't hunt that year. Their same requirements would still apply for service hours or the training course, but it allows them that option. Many of them are getting deployed during a hunt season as well. They get their service hours done, they're ready to go hunting, and then they get that letter in the mail that says they gotta go. This allows them also the option of choosing to just extend that time frame 1 more year. It doesn't extend how many deer they get to kill. It's simply just a time frame. So, on some administrative portions of these changes, we also found that from dedicated hunters within the program, there are a few each year that are lucky enough to draw the limited entry deer permit. And they call us finding out that the current rule says that if they accept that permit, they've just lost the year in their dedicated hunter program, and they still have to do the service hours. So they don't get to participate fully. We felt like the number that are in that boat is small enough that it would not be an impact to allow those folks also the option of extending their dedicated hunter COR for 1 year and take full advantage of all 3 years. This would also include any recipients of the poaching rewards, the poaching reported rewards permit. Very, very small number when it comes down to it. It does exclude those that obtain limited entry deer permits in other means, like at the expo or conservation permits, direct purchases from the CWMUs. We feel like they have a separate opportunity there. The signature requirement that we have is, in current rule, says they dedicated hunters need to sign basically a paper COR, a certificate of registration. We have just modified this to state that they need to sign their COR in the manner that the division provides, and that may continue to be paper, or like most things, it may go electronic. So this just gives us that flexibility. And then the other kind of bigger portion that we've changed is the removal of a service hour exemption for participants that are involved in educational or religious endeavors. The current rule allows, if you are gone for a 1 year minimum period during your 3 year time frame, you can opt to not hunt that year, and the division will waive the hours that you're required to do for that 1 year. In most cases, we found that either people are not gone a full year, or they're not gone a full year within their 3 year COR, or they've already done their hours, or a lot of things just got too complicated. So what we've done is removed that entirely, and made it simpler and easier for participants of all situations, whether it be a life change, a move, any of these other things. It just makes it easier for those folks to be able to withdraw from the program. where the current rule doesn't make that as easy. So current rule right here, you have the comparison from side to side there. Right now, the rule says that if you have no permits issued during your 3 years, you don't have to do any hours, but you do have to formally surrender on paper. If you had one permit issued, you can get out of this program and formally surrender or withdraw if you have 10 hours done. And then there are provisions for injury and illness situations that we did not change in the recommendation. The recommendation allows, if you have zero permits issued in your 3 years, we're not going to require 3 hours or the 32 hours. You can withdraw at any time. If you had one permit, we would require that you had 11 hours, and then you could withdraw. And we moved that to 11 because it's a little closer to the one-third of the total 32. If you had two permits issued, and this is really the big one, we would require 22 hours of service, and then you could withdraw. There is a hitch to that. If you've had two harvests, you cannot withdraw from the program. You've got to stick it out the third year and wait your third year out. Service hours, just in case they were, let's say they had 30 hours of service done, and they withdrew at zero permits issued. Believe it or not, that does happen. We would not, I want to specifically mention this, we would not be forwarding those excess service hours into a future enrollment. What they have is what they have for that three-year time frame. We don't move things into other years, other enrollments, I should say. So that's what I've got for you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Any questions from the public?
Okay, do we... John, questions?
Shook their head. Do we have a... any comments from the public? No comments?
No, I have any comments.
Okay, then we will take comments from the RAC. Okay, Gene, go ahead.
Okay, this purchasing point, don't you think that's just a lot like buying hunting privilege?
Do you want my opinion of it or the division's opinion?
I want any opinion of it. I want somebody that I don't think it's defensible.
Are you asking me if we feel it's appropriate?
If you've got a defense for it, I'll listen to it.
But purchasing
hunting privilege is. It kind of goes against everything that our general fair play in this hunting goes with.
You're talking about purchasing the service hours?
Purchasing service hours.
Okay,
I equate it to purchasing hunting privilege.
Okay. So I'll respond with one thing. And if you want more, just tell me more. The main thing... I think with this is that every sportsman has initially the same price. If you apply for the COR and you draw it, as a resident, your price is the same for every resident. It's the price of the COR fee, which is $195. That gets you your 3 years. The hunting privilege is an exchange. You can go do those service hours, and it'll cost you your time. And every sportsman can do that. There are some sportsmen that either don't have that flexibility or have other life situations where it's simpler for them to purchase the hours. Now, whether you agree with that or not, every sportsman from the beginning has the same initial cost. And it's 32 hours of service, which is time, and $195. So if they choose to purchase their hours, it costs them a whole lot more than the rest of us that perform the service.
Those funds are used to help the program, right?
Yep. Yeah, and that's a good point to add. When service hours are purchased, they go into an account the division can use. And that account can be used for a variety of things, but it's money that goes directly to the Division of Wildlife.
Does it go for, so you have the flexibility to do anything with that money, but it has to be in the division, but it just doesn't go for habitat improvement projects or anything dedicated?
No, purchased hours don't. They are put into what's called a restricted fund. It's a fund that is at the discretion, the use of the discretion of the director's office. Generally, I can tell you that it goes towards administering the program and the staff. And division personnel, wages, things like that. So it goes straight to the division.
Okay. Yep. Do you have anything else, Gene?
Yes, I do. The brunt of this program is big game. The licenses come from the big game, which is why people join the dedicated hunter program. But the efforts, what percent of all these hours and so forth go back to big game, and what goes to other things?
I like that question. And if it was up to me, I would love to see eventually that every single project had to do with deer. What I have found in the last few years as I'm working in this program is that there are more than one type of project that benefit deer. So there are those habitat projects that are specifically organized to benefit directly benefit deer. But then there are other projects like sage-grouse projects, habitat projects there. Well, they happen to live in the same place, and they happen to use a lot of the same plants, the same forage, the same sources, water, the land. If the land is bad, neither of those species can live. So what I found is many projects that benefit one species benefit deer as well. We do some stream restoration projects, and if the water quality is good, big game have support for their water. Is it possible to entirely make all of our projects for dedicating our program big game and deer related? I think it could be in certain ways. Well, we'd probably see a big reduction of the number of available projects. Our goal in the Dedicated Hunter program is to help hunters interact with wildlife recreation, wildlife habitat, become stewards. And often that means becoming stewards of all things wildlife. Deer habitat projects also have certain time frames that they can only be done. We can't do a whole lot right now. And so sometimes during the winter or the months where we're not doing habitat projects, it benefits the sportsmen to offer other things that get them involved with the division, with the landscape, with other agencies, and become partners and stewards in other ways. So I hope that helps give you a reason why we do diversify our projects. We feel they do have a reach to the division. And if we're supporting the division in those ways, that ultimately benefits wildlife.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any other comments from the RAC? Okay, seeing none, then we will entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion that we accept the proposed rule change as proposed.
I'll second.
Okay. Been moved and seconded that we accepted by
Sean
to accept the motion as proposed. Any discussion? Gene?
I've been a strong critic of this dedicated hunter program since its inception, and so I'd like to recuse myself from voting today.
Well, actually, what you want to do is vote against it is the better
statement. Yes.
Make that statement.
I'd prefer to do this.
Okay. All right. Then let's have a vote. All in favor of the motion? It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 4. And all against? Zero against and one abstention? Motion passes. Okay, other business. Do you have anything else, Kevin?
No.
Seeing none, then we will adjourn.
Next meeting is not until April.